how this is something completely different. So what we're talking about today is more of what we've been talking about. We've been talking about making sort of the constant attack. And you'll recall we talked about the bacterial agents. Streptococcus pneumoniae, which you have down someplace, which is positive. Mosquito pneumoniae, which is gram negative. Bacterial pneumoniae, which is also gram negative.
Typical
bacterial kind of problem or viral problem, when you cough, you bring something up and for a period of time you don't have to cough again. This is not that way. This is constant contact. There may be a mild fever, 100 to 101. It will wax and wane, it comes and goes. And the problem persists for many weeks that lead into many months. The initial diagnosis is commonly missed unless it's part of a cluster in which the index of suspicion of the physician rises when they start seeing more than one case of it. So not until we see an x-ray do we realize that this is as severe as it is. The x-ray will be that of an interstitial pneumonia, more characteristic of a viral pneumonia, that is going to be scattered evenly throughout the lobes of the lung, not just the tip of the lung, the typical bacterial, and it's going to be spread in the alveolar wall. So sometimes this is called walking pneumonia because the person gets diagnosed after they've been sick for many, many months. The treatment is usually uncomplicated, but obviously involves something other than a cell wall synthesis inhibitor. Now, protein synthesis inhibitors in many categories will work quite commonly. But even after we get rid of the organism, it may take another 4 to 6 weeks to get rid of that nasty cough. And for our x-rays to start looking normal again. Because the parts of the organism, cell membrane, phospholipids, are what's actually triggering the T-cells to divide. And even after the organism has been killed by a protein synthesis inhibitor, which is a bacteriostatic type agent, that's often, that process will take a long time to clear the person's lung. So it's a gradual onset, lasts for a long period of time, a relatively mild illness of coughing and mild fever, but it just doesn't go away easily. So one can easily be at the beginning of a cough and the end of a cough and so finally get out of it. It could easily have taken up 3 or 4 months of your life. Rarely was this resulting in death. I think there's one woman whose death certificates have apparently indicated that this is a problem, but that's quite unlikely. So it's not going to be a massive killer of the population, but it's a nuisance kind of thing. Because it is a T cell migration, there's some concern if you have an HIV positive patient whose T cells have the genetic information for the virus inserted into them, into their genome. And as a result, if we activate that cell to this mitogenic stimulation, we activate the virus. And so it increases the development of the progression of HIV to the full blown AIDS, and therefore decreases the life of the person. We see this, as we mentioned, in clusters. Commonly we see this in children, but we can still see this all the way through college years. And probably in part due to just the confinement rather than the immune system that we typically think of children and so on. Probably just the close proximity to other people who have it. This clustering effect. So daycares and things get this. There's one sort of an oddball serological test that is a non-specific test that is often associated with this particular organism. Non-specific meaning it's not uniquely antigenic response, but it's something characteristic of the person, something known as cold agglutinins, where group O blood will agglutinate because the patient will stimulate an antibody, a class of antibodies, usually immunoglobulin M or IgM, which is our biggest antibody. And this big antibody will cause red cells to pump in the cold. They're called cold agglutinins. And it's one of those non-specific things. There are other agents that can cause it, but a cold agglutinin test is often seen on the market diagnosis for the physician of a cold agglutinin test, so that's what that is. Nothing more than they have an antibody, usually an IgM class, which is a very large antibody, that causes in the laboratory, because we don't have 4 degree people body temperatures for too long, right? So we do this at 4 degrees. and put it in the refrigerator, and then see the red cells pumping only in the cold, and cold and gluten. Legionella pneumophila. The second agent, the primary, is pneumonia. The mycoplasma lasts for a long time, not just a matter of a few days to a few weeks, lasting months, and it was not susceptible to cell ulcer inhibitor, hence the atypical nature. Legionella pneumophila, atypical nature. This is a gram-negative organism. So what's the gram stain on mycoplasma? There isn't any, it's neither, right? I never saw all the stain. What is the shape of mycoplasma? Pleomorphic, it doesn't have a shape, right? There's no cell wall to give a shape. So these are the pneumophila gram-negative organism. This organism is an agent of atypical pneumonia because it has very abrupt and likely to possible fatal outcome. So the infection of Legionella pneumophila of a duration of anywhere from 3 to 5 days can be a lethal problem. Sometimes patients die rather quickly with this. It got its name because in 1976, when a bunch of legionnaires were having their party and their convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and they were dropping water balloons out of the hotel windows and all that kind of good stuff, several of them came down with Legionnaires' disease because they were legionnaires. At that point in time, it was an unknown agent. And there were a lot of questions as to what was causing it. They thought that maybe these were anti-Vietnam War protesters that were poisoning these people, and there was all kinds of different things going on. But it turned out to be nothing more than a bacterial infection. And with a rapidly fulminating disease course, people die quickly. When we see a rapidly fulminating disease course, what sort of virulence factor is often involved? An exotoxin, exactly. Okay, so we have an exotoxin. And then we find out that not all isolates of the organism have this exotoxin. So we find the organism in the environment, usually in water environments. Fountains are a great place to put them. But they can be in cooling towers for air conditioning units, in a variety of those kind of places, but we are circulating water. But many times when we isolate it, there's no, it's not causing disease. And other times there's an outbreak and we look in the fountain and the air conditioning unit, and sure enough, there's the organism. So what do you think is the difference between the organism, Legionella pneumophila, that causes this problem, and the organism, Legionella pneumophila, that doesn't? We said it's an exotoxin. So sometimes there's an exotoxin and sometimes there isn't. What would account for that? The brain's got to recalculate things. Put the calculator down and the square root of the answer. Put it on a log or semi-log graph. What do you think? How does sometimes the organism cause problems? What do you think? How are exotoxins moved about? Mechanism of moving in the mouth. Yes. Transduction, exactly. So we have a virus. We haven't isolated the virus, but it smells like a virus, and walks like a virus, and talks like a virus. We just haven't found it yet. So we figure that there's a virus that invades this, and that would be similar to one other kind of sort of prototype organism that has a virus, and sometimes it causes a problem, and it doesn't have the virus, it doesn't cause a problem. And that one we actually know the name of the bacteriophage, phage. Diphtheria. And the bacteriophage was betaphage. Okay? So that's a good prototype. And since we see that kind of unusual epidemiology, sometimes the organism causes a problem, sometimes it doesn't cause a problem. When it causes a problem, it causes a rapidly fulminating thing. Go on. Smells like a virus. Acts like an exotoxin. So we haven't isolated it yet, but we will. we have lignanemophilia. You know what it is? It's odd that it just popped up now. It turns out, not so fast, that in the years previously we had a variety of other problems that were just unknown problems. One of them was called Pontiac fever for Pontiac, Michigan. As it turned out, they had body parts of people that died, bits of lung and so on. And they had serology for the people that died. They took serum. It's all frozen away in Pontiac, Michigan. So the guys from Philadelphia fly to Pontiac, Michigan. And sure enough, same bug. Same toxin, same bug. So it has been around a while. And it pops up periodically. We see it, about 3 years ago, there was an epidemic of sorts, several cases, 50 cases, something like that, in Detroit. And you look around, and the pattern of disease, just take a city map and find out where it is, and then look where the big fountain is, and it was downwind from the fountain, a little cloud, a mist of organisms. Okay, so we get these organisms in the fountain, and it sprays. That's why the microbiologists have concerns when we go into some of the very fancy kinds of hospitals that have the registration area to walk in, the biotechnology, the kitchen room, and that kind of stuff, like a big hotel. You just have a big hotel in the lobby area, they have fancy chairs and everything, lounges, and they have a fountain. My goodness, they still have a fountain. Even good old Bo Rapids here, you walk into the atrium that they have and so on, there's a little fountain and a little waterfall. Nice architectural feature, dumb idea to put in a hospital. Okay. So we have Legionella pneumophilia associated with the primary atrial pneumonia. It's a rapidly progressing problem, rapidly fulminating, can result in death. Again, once we recognize that it wasn't people being poisoned and so on, it's not difficult to treat once we know what it is. Okay. So we have a very abrupt exotoxin-related problem, not the typical Streptococcus pneumonia, Haemophilus influenzae. Very rapidly fatal. And then we have one that lingers and lingers and lingers. And the spawns all things and all and so on. And that was number five. This is two agents, a primary agent, typical pneumonia or PAP. And you will see them on exams and so on. So make sure you recognize the difference between the two and so on. Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Obviously an acid-fast organism. We have one that doesn't have cell wall, not gram positive, gram negative, acid fast, and we have gram negative, and now we have an acid fast organism. Now, these acid fast organisms, there are many of them. And they're all going to be treated in the same way. Isoniazid is going to be part of the treatment. And isoniazid blocks the making of mycolic acid, an important, unique ingredient in structure, component from the structure of the acid fast cell wall. Classic one that we'll spend most of the time on when we're talking about Mycobacterium tuberculosis, but notice that we also have Mycobacterium abram. Abram is associated with birds and pigs, and you can see that there on the side. The bird association is where the name abram comes from. We don't call the disease tuberculosis because we limit that definition and terminology to Mycobacterium tuberculosis, but it's essentially the same kind of problem. We call it tuberculosis-like. Mycobacterium bovis, which is associated with cattle. But in Michigan, of course, it's in the deer herd. By the way, it also can be transmitted to humans. And occasionally humans get it, but it's not too common, but it's possible. When we send the vets from Michigan State out to the cattle farm in Michigan that has the cattle that have got in bovis, cats have it, the cat that hangs around the barnyard, the dog may have it, various kinds of meat and squirrels and ferrets and so on who have it that same geographical area, they'll all have it. Okay? So a variety of vegans can get it. Humans are an unlikely possibility, but it can be gotten. And in Michigan, of course, the problem was the way in which the various hunting associations were mass feeding the deer in the wintertime so that they would survive the spring and they could be shot in the fall. And so in an effort to keep the herd alive during the winter, they would provide feeding stations. Now deer, typically, if you ride along the road, you'll see two or three deer at a time. You won't see too many herds of deer. And what happens when we have the feeding is we have them in close proximity to each other. And so we might have 50 or 100, 150 deer all in an area the size of this room. They're all eating the same food. And they're rubbing their noses to one another as they fight for the food. So in that setting, it spreads easily from animal to animal. When they're scattered around the countryside in groups of 2 or 3, it's not as easy to spread. So the feeding of the cattle was where, excuse me, the feeding of the deer in that manner is how it spread into the deer population. Mycobacterium fortunatum is associated with wound infections. Can mycobacterium tuberculosis be associated with wound infections? You bet. So we think of mycobacterium tuberculosis in the lungs, but it can also cause a wound problem. Mycobacterium kansasi, obviously found in Ohio, found in Kansas, is another one of those unusual mycobacterium-like agents. And we have something totally different, Mycobacterium leprae. Notice the name there, Hansen's bacillus, going back to a Scandinavian investigator who studied it. For some reason, probably because of priest named Father Damien who worked with lepers in Hawaii, we tend to think incorrectly that leprosy is something that occurs only in tropical climates or something like that. No, and certainly Hansen and Bacillus, named for a fellow who studied tuberculosis in the Scandinavian countries as far from the tropical area. And so we tend to think that that's familiar with tropical diseases. It's not. We do have leprosy in the United States. It's not a common problem, but we do have. We do actually have two centers: one in Hawaii, which leads to that Father Damien idea, and one in Louisiana. These are national centers for treatment of leprosy. Just as an aside, leprosy has its problem in the peripheral nervous system, which leads to a loss of sensations. The loss of sensations then enhances the likelihood of the individual to have infections that are not treated, to have injuries that are not recognized, and that leads to loss of fingers and toes. And then the organism also has an effect, a strong effect, almost like an allergic reaction, on your T-cell immunity, which then creates these granulomas which you can appear on the skin. It also is a mycobacterium marineum that affects marine animals such as fish and can cause skin lesions in humans, quite commonly fishermen and women. And mycobacterium ulcerans, which causes a skin lesion, an ulcer lesion. So that's sort of the wide group there of mycobacterium species. Remember, they're going to be treated in the same manner with the same agent. Mentioning treatment here just for a second. The agents that we treat, quite commonly we use isoniazid. The isoniazid is similar to cannabidiol. Isoniazid, again, blocks the making of mycolic acid. We often use isoniazid, sulfa drugs, and others. Usually you use about 2 compounds at a time. Rifampin would be a common third. So sulfa drugs, rifampin, and isoniazid. Usually isoniazid is carried through several different variations, keeping it in there with the others. Isoniazid is very effective for this. It's a limited effective agent working only on the acid fast. But it also has some toxic side effects, particularly on the liver. And so patients have to have liver function monitoring during the time in which they're treated. The organism grows really slowly. It divides once every 24 hours or so. Some of the fast-growing varieties divide every 18 hours. Some of the other ones as long as 28 hours. finger roughly once a day, as opposed to every 20 minutes. This real slow dividing means the time that it's critical relative to making a cell wall only appears for a few minutes every day. So therefore, what's happening is that you have to treat this for a very long period of time. Short course treatment, when the organism's only found in the lungs and hasn't spread throughout the body yet, could be anywhere 3 to 6 months. Short course. The variation time, we wait until the person's sputum samples are negative to the organism. Remember, sputum sample is not saliva, but it's bringing down the good stuff from the chest itself. And if the patient has difficulty bringing up the sputum sample, we can just do a needle biopsy where we have a tube that we can put in the trachea that sucks out potential sample. After that, the patients decide that they can maybe bring one up on their own. When they see the needle, they suddenly be very cooperative. And so we need to do this repeatedly until we have a negative sample. Now, this sample is really gooey, obviously, if it's done properly. And so what we do is we pour in one normal HCl. One normal sodium hydroxide. So one normal sodium hydroxide, NaOH. And that will liquefy the sputum, and we then centrifuge that down and look at the pellet from the organism. So one normal sodium hydroxide is not harmful to the organism in the least. That is acid fast so well. Now there are patients that organisms that are resistant to the standard fare, and we use 3 at a time, and we switch them off every 2 weeks and so on. Because organisms are resistant to the standard fare, and we just mentioned them as being highly resistant. And then there are those that are resistant to most, if not all, and we call them extreme resistant organisms. And we are concerned about the development of these extremely resistant organisms. And the use of antibiotics in other countries, particularly the former Soviet Union, which has a high prison population with a high rate of tuberculosis. And the treatment with the drugs was done rather haphazardly, leading to the development of many extremely resistant isolates. In the general population, outside of those closed populations, it has been slow in coming. It's coming, but it's not as quickly as we had feared. It's still a problem. What we do in the United States with those patients that are with isolates of extreme variety is we typically, if we can do this, depending on the extent of infection, is remove the lung surgically. So remove those portions of the lung where the organism is. Now I say that in the United States, that's what we do. In other parts of the world, in Germany and other parts of Europe and so on, typically that's a first line approach rather than a last line approach. So it's not at all uncommon for part of the lung lobe to be removed on early diagnosis of tuberculosis, even in the event of it not being an extreme resistant organism. We will use drugs first, and we will use surgery first. We will use surgery ultimately. So that's the extreme variety. This is a typical data point that one should be taking a look at. This is an analysis looking at, as you can see, ages of populations and looking at various ethnic groups, Hispanic being a particular target of this one, but we also see some Native Americans mentioned in Pacific Islanders. There's an inference that somehow an ethnic group is at risk because of their ethnicity. When we look at that and sort of come to that conclusion, that's not the proper conclusion. Agent is associated with those individuals whose immune system is not completely strong. If your T-cell immunity, which is primary, what you're going to need for this, is in any way diminished, then you are at risk of getting tuberculosis. One of the ways in which that can be diminished is being poorly fed, so malnourished individuals. It has nothing to do with their ethnicity, which you can see someone can do the calculations. And this is not making funky data, this is actual data and so on. but the conclusions which you draw from the data can be misleading. Okay. The hidden factor there is the nutritional status of the individual, not the ethnicity of the individual. Going back to tuberculosis now, we know it's acid fast, and we know that it can grow in a wound now. So how do we get this into our body? Well, we can eat the organism, we can inhale the organism, aspirate it, or we can get it into a wound site. The organism will be readily phagocytized, as we now know from our earlier discussion. And we'll use the phagocytic cells as a taxicab to travel around the body. Within about 2 to 4 days, the regional lymph nodes will begin to be populated with this organism. So that means the mesenteric lymph nodes in the gut, or your cut in your hand, or in your arm, and so on. Or in the chest area, we'll see lymph nodes there. The organism will then have a more effective area of growth, where we have lots of these phagocytic cells, and therefore we're going to see them in the lungs and the lining of the brain. And secondarily, we may also see them in the kidneys. If we find the organism only in the lungs, that's when we use this short course therapy. If we find it elsewhere, then we use a longer term therapy, which could be years, until the person is completely clean of the organism. We also remember from earlier discussions that the body's response to antibody, which is a opsonizing kind of thing, which is to enhance phagocytosis, is totally ineffective. So antibody doesn't work at all. Our T-cell response, however, is somewhat effective because it walls it off in an area called a granuloma. The organism can survive inside this granuloma. The T cell killing efficiency is not very great. So inside this little granuloma, about the size of a dime or maybe a nickel, this sphere, that's where the organism is. After a few weeks of formation, the granuloma will begin to be populated with calcium. Calcification of an unusual structure in the body is a common phenomenon. Athletes that have damage to their ligaments often have calcium formations and so on. You hear bone spurs and things of that nature for athletes. That's just simply the reaction to injury of certain tissues. Well, part of the reaction to the presence of the granuloma is calcification, which allows it to be easily seen on X-ray. And so we see these little round cannonballs where the organism is. If we successfully treat with antimicrobial agents, the antimicrobial agent will penetrate into the granuloma and kill the organism. Patients, if they have extensive infection, again, will have to take this for a very long period of time, potentially years. You get it early, months, long-term, years. And under public health laws, you can be forced to take the medication or be imprisoned and isolated. Occasionally, you'll hear a public health announcement. There's a woman with a Native American name, whose name pops up every 2 years, who lives in the Traverse City County area, and they look for her every once in a while because she's not taking her medication. So there's a public announcement for Mrs. So-and-so, whatever her name is, and they have to find her and make sure that she's taking medication, or else they can imprison her. That's the public health law. Public health laws were devised when we did not have proper treatment with antibiotics. When we actually isolated the population, anyone who had it was kept away from the rest of the population. Imprisonment's a little severe, but that's basically what it was. We call these sanitariums. Sanitariums were scattered around in every state. In the 1930s, the Germans had a sort of back-to-nature movement. And in this back-to-nature movement, they thought that fresh air was really, really good for you, particularly healthy if you were infected with tuberculosis. So they began to build the sanitariums in mountain places, in course, we did the same. The few remaining sanitariums are in the mountains, like in Denver and so on. Denver remains one of the main centers in the United States, but still the treatment and sometimes surgery, removal of lungs and so on, is done in Denver. The Jewish hospital in Denver. We had this weird idea about mountain air and so on. It even influenced culture. You see typical suburban houses, they have the garage on the first floor and so on, and above it they'll have bedrooms and so on. And outside the bedrooms they'll have these little fake balconies. Extra architectural feature. Well, that's from when in the 1920s and 30s, the German architect, they actually had a large balcony that you could move your bed out into and sleep outside on the balcony to get that fresh air, even in the wintertime. They even had a modification where just the part that just opened up to slide the bed out so your head would be outside and your body would be on the inside. But we have this vestigial kind of little museum. That architectural feature came from that. In the 1800s, tuberculosis affected the haute couture, the high fashion industry in Paris. And that has an impact on us still today. Prior to that particular 1800s epidemic, the ideal woman, something that men came up with, right? The ideal woman was the German term, Zofbik. Maybe a size 18 to 22 dress. Big woman. Okay. That was the ideal woman. Artists like Rubin, I think that was Rubinesque woman. That was the typical thing. Then we have tuberculosis hitting the high fashion industry. And one of the names for tuberculosis is consumption. Because of the impact on your immune system, you produce a variety of attempts from your T cells to kill the organism. One of those signals, or cytokines, is called tumor necrosis factor, TNF. There are various varieties, alpha, beta, and so on, but TNF, or tumor necrosis factor, is a cytokine coming from a lymphocyte, so that makes it a lymphokine. And this lymphokine from T cell lymphocytes attacks the body. Tumor necrosis factor. But obviously a person that has tuberculosis doesn't have a tumor, they have to bring along with it. But nonetheless, being spun off. And that causes the body to lose significant weight, hence the term consumption. And so what happened when this hit the high fashion industry in Paris, the dress size went down to about 2. This very thin, weight-like person became the ideal woman because of tuberculosis. We still have body image things in women and all that sort of stuff. Okay. So where is the idea that the ideal woman has to do these things? It came from tuberculosis. Strange. There's also cytokines that affect the brain and how it functions. And there are many, in the 1800s, many of the famous poets and philosophers and so on had tuberculosis. And it was thought to give them greater insight, clarity of mind, as they coughed out blood in the process of dying, being consumed. So they had various kinds of perfumes, they said that the smell would be helpful. They had perfumed handkerchiefs, all that dress styles and all those things. That when buildings are built, all the social impact of the disease. So this has been around for a while. So the person has the organism that gets into a lesion, like on the hand or something like that. By the way, that's why we have no spitting laws, so that you don't spit in buses and so on. So if someone has a cut and they touch the seat that someone spat upon and so on. All of those health laws go back to the world. But once we began treating with isoniazid, we no longer needed the sanitariums, and we basically turned them down for the morning and so on. The organism is in your lungs, and you've had it there for many months. And let's assume that you did not get it treated. In now spreads and gets into the brain and into the kidneys. So patients' urine samples can have the organism. And as it does so, after probably someplace around 3 to 5 years of this disease, the body's immune system will start spitting off even more cytokines than before. Sort of a frustration. Not only is this consumption going down, their body is wasting away, but as their vital capacity and their lung capacity is changing, getting less, they have to breathe more deeply, and they actually get barrel-chested. So we have barrel-chested individuals who are wasting away. And so that's the body image that we've got. Inside, their lung capacity is not only being impacted by the organism's effect on you, but your immune effect on the organism is producing compounds that that basically cause a phenomenon known as caseation. Caseation from milk. It looks like cheese. Okay? The inside lung, I can get a picture today, but I didn't. It's this cheese formation. Okay? It's caseation. So when you crack open the chest, it's all mushy. No function. And we want to avoid that caseation. That's why if we can't effectively treat it, we remove it with surgery. Again, that caseation is the immune response to the organism. So we can have good things happen with it, with the immunity, but also not so good ones. What about prevention? Well, we have a vaccine. Is named after a couple of Frenchmen. Bacillus Calmette and Guérin. Calmette and Guérin are two fellows at the Pasteur Institute that took the organism and passaged it, that is, went from animal to animal, until it lost the ability to cause human disease. So they took the human pathogen, put it into animals, took it out of that sick animal, put it in another sick animal, and repeatedly did this. It's called passaging. Until it no longer causes human disease. Basically, what they're doing is the organism was, quote, adapting to these other hosts, but in the process of adapting, it was having genetic deletions. And so we analyzed the agent, which is a living agent, the live attenuated organism, meaning it's not causing disease because of these deletions, but it's still living. And we can expose you to that, and you'll develop a strong T-cell response. And areas of the world in which tuberculosis is endemic, meaning a high concentration in a localized area, that is the recommendation to use that. World Health Organization recommendation. So we immunize those areas of the world that have high rates of indigenous population having tuberculosis. Endemic. So if you were born in the Philippines and certain parts of Europe and Middle East and so on, you may have been immunized with BCG, Bacillus Calmette Guérin, and you will then be protected against tuberculosis. It's not 100% protected, but then few things are 100% guaranteed. But in the risk factor in your local area, that is a reasonable risk to take. In the United States, it is not an endemic situation. And we do not immunize our population routinely with BCG. What we do is we skin test. So if you were exposed to the organism, we give you an extract of the organism. Okay, called a purified protein derivative, or PPD. Purified protein derivative of tuberculosis is injected into your skin. PPD, purified protein derivative. All of you will have this done. You've already had it done once, yes? And that's just sort of a baseline. So when you are exposed, and it's likely that you may be exposed to tuberculosis, particularly in a hospital setting, the typical scenario is the following. You're out on the floors, you're checking meds and so on. Someone just moved from one unit to another, the paperwork hasn't caught up with them yet. You're visiting them, checking your meds, Maybe they're on the cancer floor, they're coughing because they have lung cancer. Yes, that's true, but they're also coughing because they have tuberculosis. That didn't come up yet in the paperwork. You find out 2 days later that everyone who had contact with Mr. Smith from 204 West was going to have PPD check for testing for tuberculosis and skin testing. So that's how that'll come up. So you will be skin tested repeatedly throughout your career, particularly if you're working in a hospital setting. Now, what we're doing with the skin testing is exposing your immune system to components of the organism. That will not result in you developing a positive skin test later. Okay? So repeated skin testing doesn't give you a positive skin test. Two types of skin tests, qualitative and quantitative. The qualitative basically is yes or no, quantitative is how much. Qualitative test, the typical one that you use, a skin test, it's called a patch test. What we do is we basically take a forearm or some flat area that we need to get to, rough it up a little bit, like sandpaper, but not really sandpaper, we rough it up a little bit, and then we put on a band-aid, a patch. And on the surface of the band-aid, the face of that roughed up area is PPD. After 48 hours, we put off, it takes us roughly 48 hours to have a good T cell response. 48 hours. We pull it off, we look for a red reaction. A red reaction is a positive skin test, meaning that your body's T cell immunity has been alerted to tuberculosis. And that's usually sufficient for most patients in most settings, and that will then trigger a chest X-ray, generally as a baseline. The granuloma might not be there yet. And then we'll begin treatment. And again, that could be 3 months or so, depending upon how much of a problem you seem to have. And in sputum samples, we find out that they're negative. So we have repeated negative, usually 3 sputum samples that are negative. And a chest X-ray that doesn't change over a period of 3 months is sufficient generally to stop the treatment. Remember, though, that isoniazid can be a problem. This is not like taking regular antibiotics. Isoniazid is a serious, nasty bug for some people. Can result in liver failure. Liver failure means liver transplant. Liver failure means big, lifelong problems. Okay? So you do need to have a liver testing done. So it's not an inexpensive procedure. Liver testing, x-rays, drugs, multiple drugs. We have another category, and this happens also with students that typically go to Paris, and we have students that call me back after they've been gone for a few years, and we go through the same thing I'm going to tell you right now. If you have been immunized as a child because you came from some place that immunizes people, what do you think is going to happen when this skin test comes up? It's going to come up positive. Okay. And when it comes up positive, then the bells will go off and ringing and people get all excited and so on, and they take that antibiotics and all that sort of stuff, x-rays and so on. Now, if it was just taking an occasional x-ray or something, or even a standard antibiotic, it might not be too bad. But because isoniazid will be part of that treatment, and because isoniazid may in fact cause damage to your liver, this is to be taken with some degree of seriousness. In that setting, I recommend that you find ahead of time a physician in your area who's looking to do a second kind of test known as a MANTOO, M-A-N-T-O-U-X, the MANTOO test. This is the quantifiable kind of test, typically done in multiple concentrations of PPD injected into the skin. If you have only a minor reaction at the highest concentration of PPD, chances are quite likely that you are not actually infected. That it's just a remnant of that childhood immunization. On the other hand, if you are reacting strongly even to the lowest concentration, you probably in fact are infected. So we do multiple concentrations. If the highest concentration doesn't do anything, no reaction, and the middle concentration doesn't do anything, no reaction, and only if the lowest concentration doesn't do anything, the middle concentration, and only the highest concentration. concentration due to the smallest reaction, then we probably are going to say, you don't need to take the drug. Maybe a chest x-ray, come back a little later and take the medication. That avoids you taking the medication. But if you don't do anything, preferably if you don't do anything ahead of time, chances are the bureaucracy will have you start taking drugs. And they could be running around looking for a physician who was born in India or something that understands your problem because they have the same problem. Okay? So you don't want to take isoniazid unless you have to. And so that's an important little tidbit for you. The reaction that we see not only is a red reaction in both the MAN2 and the PAS, but it's a redness and induration. The phrase induration means a thickening of the skin. So it puffs up a little bit. It's not just simply a red reaction like you see with the SHIP test and the DIC test and so on. It's other skin tests, but with antibody-based skin tests. This is a CMI or T-cell-based skin test. And you see not only redness, but a puffiness, an induration, a thickness of the skin. Those of you that travel around the world and do mission work and things of that nature, you will see tuberculosis, you will be exposed to tuberculosis, and you're putting yourself at risk relative to getting tuberculosis and needing the treatment. The symptoms in case you think you might get it, but the symptoms of this are certainly going to be a cough and a fever, often with night sweats. Flu-like symptoms. When you hear the phrase night sweats and flu-like symptoms, think of T-cell cytokine responses. That's what you're seeing. T-cell cytokine responses. And it's a typical situation with these agents. Besides the cough and everything else that you expect. And of course, you can get meningitis in the organism, and so on. So it's a difficult organism to treat. Multiple antibiotic resistance, highly drug resistant, and extreme drug resistant varieties on the horizon are currently not too much of a problem, but occasionally appear in the United States. Oh, one other thing, I think we started reading a little tablet. BCG, the immunization, is sometimes used as a shock to the immune system. BCG, on occasion, is given to patients who have a cancer or something like that their immune system is sort of weakened. The BCG is given as a shock. It's not treating the infection, not treating tuberculosis, not treating the cancer directly, but stimulating an immune response. That goes in and out of fashion. And again, I just got a call about a week ago from a former student who said, they're doing this. And you said something about it. What did you say about it? I can't tell you what they're doing. But basically, BCG is used as a shock to stimulate particularly a cell-mediated immune response against the cancer. They're not treating tuberculosis. They're not thinking the patient has tuberculosis. They're just trying to wake up the immune system. One final thought, and we'll come back to this a little later with the HIV. If you or I were to come down with tuberculosis, okay, we might not know about that, by the way. Right? But if we were coming down with tuberculosis, that means that maybe we have some deficiency of our immune system. Assuming that we're well nourished, that shouldn't be a problem. Assuming we're not at a very young age or very old age, that's not the problem. So why did this person come down with a full-blown disease? Because the organism is very, very likely to cause infection, but it's not so likely to actually cause disease. So if you actually have disease, it would do a check on your immune system. And one of the things we're going to check for is, are you HIV positive? So if a person comes down with tuberculosis, who is in your age range, who doesn't have any known deficiencies in their immune system, we will do an AIDS testing on it. The organism is highly infectious, but not easily causing disease. right out of me, if I were to have tuberculosis and talking to lecturers and walking up and down, it's quite likely that 3/4 of you would come up skin test positive. But nobody would actually get tuberculosis. Okay. And there's been all kinds of interesting oddball things that demonstrated that kind of statistic. But if I were to have tuberculosis, then one of the things we'd be testing to see, if I had AIDS or leukemia, or why did I actually come down with the actual disease? You might see a question like that on the exam. It could happen. Okay, oral cavity-associated infections. Acute versus chronic. Okay, so we can have an acute problem, such as an abscess of some sort. A chronic situation, maybe a tooth decay, if you don't have to get that. We have acute versus chronic infection. We have local versus systemic. We have tooth decay basically going to be in your mouth, whereas an abscess can, as we indicated earlier, drain and you can aspirate the organism and get it into your lung. We talked about secondary bacterial agents, and I mentioned about metastatic agents. So systemic meaning throughout the body, local meaning in a certain area. The first thing we'll take a look at are the dental caries. Okay, just so you know what this is. First thing we have is a plaque that forms. A plaque is a matrix of particles of food and organisms, particularly organisms that have a gooey secretion. It may not be a true capsule, but it could be a capsular-like material that's secreted. Sometimes called a slime layer. Slime layers are different than capsules, and the slime layers easily rinse off the organism. And so we have this gooey slime mixed with the food and the organism, and it adheres to the enamel surface. The organisms then ferment and produce acid end products, lowering the pH of the surface of the enamel. That lowered pH demineralizes the enamel. As a result, we have a hole, or a dental carrier. So tooth decay is a result of demineralization of the enamel due to low pH. You can do the same thing if you suck on vitamin C pills and things like that. You can do the same sort of thing. And babies who drink milk and let the milk sit in their mouth for long periods of time and all that sort of stuff, so we can do that. Pregnant women who vomit a lot and don't brush their teeth as often, the acid conditions. So acid conditions can do this damage to the teeth. But the typical tooth decay is really nothing more than demineralization. It was found out in the western areas of the United States, in Wyoming and Colorado and so on, that individuals who had fluoride naturally occurring in the water had less tooth decay. And so now we fluorinate the water in most places, although some places refuse to fluorinate the water. Reed City, just north of us, when the fluorination came to their city, there was a big outcry about at that time how the communists were going to infiltrate our bodies and ruin our souls. And fluorination of the water was contaminating us. This is what was in the news. It was all about. Reed City, Michigan, and other places around the world do not believe in fluorination of water, so it's not, water is not fluorinated. But everybody else has got the teeth taken care of. And so what fluoride does is it penetrates enamel and bone, to your bones as well, and what it does is it makes the enamel more acid stable. That's all it does. It just makes it so that it's not affected by the demineralization of low pH. It's not that people brush their teeth any better or anything like that. It's fluoride in drinking water. Fluoride, for those people who live in cities in similar areas, or people who are in well water and such, you can get fluoride tablets. You can have fluoride treatments at the dentist. Pregnant women can take fluoride for the development of teeth and lymphatics and so on. There's a concern on occasion about toxic levels of fluoride. We have fluoride in all kinds of things.
the amount that we put into drinking water, you would probably drink enough to drown before you actually cause any problems in terms of fluoride. So it's a possible problem that one can have, but not a likely problem. The only place where it might become a problem is someone overdosed on some sort of fluoride tablets or something like that. But they'd have to do it chronically. So it's not that you're going to get it to drinking water, which is always concerned, but drinking water, and it's in the water that you use to mix pop and soda and whatever. So it's all around you. But the levels that we see are not going to be toxic levels. Theoretically, yes, but practically, no. Okay. So fluoride prevents the organism. And the key organism has this slime layer that's found in the mouth, the Streptococcus mutans. Now, with strep mutans, we thought, well, maybe we could stimulate an immune response to the organism, and that immune response would then protect you from having tooth decay. To immunize you against tooth decay, that was thought to be an interesting idea. It was tried in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and finally we realized that the kind of antibodies that we find in bodily fluids, such as saliva, and mucosal secretions in other parts of the body, the lining of the gut, and lagrimal flora, and so on, that mucosal secretion is called a secretory antibody. And the classic one is secretory immunoglobulin A, or IgA. Secretory IgA. And secretory IgA has sort of an unusual problem, and that is that it lacks memory. So in order to have a response to a secretory IgA in saliva or in the mucosal surface, in the gut or wherever, we have to have constant stimulation. And we just couldn't develop a vaccine that would do just that. So we don't have vaccines at this point in time because we have a problem with the immune response on that lining of the mucosal surface. We don't have that problem with the organism is actually in the bloodstream because we do have memory immunity there. But not on mucosal surfaces. This is why we have problems with repeated infections in areas that are protected by a mucosal surface. And we'll get more of that in time, but GI tract, obviously, mucosal surface. Periodontal disease. Well, with the advent of fluoride treatment, the drill and fill business by the dentist declined significantly. That used to be really big. Kids would come in and get 30 cavities filled. And that was profitable. And suddenly kids would come in and say, one cavity. Oh my goodness, I got a cavity. Now that's good for the kid, but not so good for the drill and fill business or the dentistry. Okay. So for a while in the 1970s and early 80s, it was thought that dentistry was going to have to trim back the number of dentists. Dental schools have to close down, reduce class sizes and all that kind of stuff. But lo and behold, the teeth which were now staying in the body longer were falling out. And it was for people, good news for dentists. This is a gum disease. A perfectly fine tooth, saved from tooth decay by fluoride, now loose and falling out. Periodontal disease, gum disease. Different kinds of gum disease. Gingivitis, which is nothing more than inflammation of the gum. You'll notice that when you're brushing your teeth and you get a tinge of blood in there, that's gingivitis. The next stage up of gingivitis is acute necrotizing ulcerative gingivitis. So A-N-U-G is acute, meaning it wasn't there yesterday, the boy hurt today. Acute necrotizing, which means dead tissue. Ulcerative, meaning you've got a little focal pit there, a little focus, an ulcer, a spot under gum that really hurts. Gingivitis, A-N-U-G, acute necrotizing ulcerative gingivitis. Sometimes called trench mouth, because it's common associated with soldiers in World War I who were in the trenches. The next stage up is chronic destructive keratoconjunctivitis. This is now someone who is in his 40s and 50s and 60s whose teeth are falling out. They actually loosen up first. You get to the point where his teeth hurt a little bit and you push on, oh my God, it moved. It didn't really move, it just, I thought it moved. It does move. My tooth is moving. That can't be good, okay? And so that's your first sign that you've got a problem. That's the chronic obstructive peritonitis. What happens then is you have a gingival surface. You've got the red, you see the happy tooth? Okay. Right, happy tooth, and you have a gingival surface here. And when you go to the dental hygienist, they measure this distance here. Okay, that's the gingival pocket. Right. And so you hear them sort of like depth sounding, you know, 6 millimeters, 5 millimeters, 3 millimeters, 7 millimeters, whatever they are. And then stick a probe around the edge of the tube, measuring the net depth. Well, what happens in this case is that the depth gets very deep, and the distance from your tooth gets pretty wide. And so we have this whole area here with organism. And it actually penetrates down into the area where the roots are and attacks the bone that supports the tooth. So we have a major invasion this way at the gingival surface. We can do this several ways. We can, maybe you'll have to lose the tooth. Maybe we can trim back and stimulate growth. They even have transplants where they move the gingival surface from one place to another. Try to fill that gap in. Now the way to prevent that is to get your teeth clean. And there's a little bit of commercial medicine in here that's very interesting. This may have an impact on your commercial career. The dentistry industry knows that the problem is that depth that we just talked about. And to remove that, it's usually a calcium buildup on the edge of the tooth that pushes the gingival surface away. Okay. So if we scrape away that calcium deposit, which the dental hygienist called calculus, you could scrape away that calcium deposit, the gingival surface will grow back on. And as it gets closer, it gets more shallower, and you're protecting the roots. Good thing. So we scrape that all out. Another painful process sometimes, but that's what happens. That's when you're getting your teeth clean. But wait, before you leave, we'll put on this little bracer that will grind up a little bit the surface of the enamel and make everything very, very bright. So you leave and you feel this clean teeth and you look bright. And that's what the person goes to get done. They go to get their teeth bright. They let that feeling of smooth of their tongue, that's what they really go for. That's just cosmetic. Okay. The real problem is that pulling that calculus stuff out, the calcium deposit, which then gets the gingival surface up against the tooth, which prevents this destructive peritonitis. Okay. So they attract you, it's a bait and switch, but it's a healthy bait and switch. They attract you to get bright, small teeth, and then bingo, they get you in there and they pull the stuff out. And the last thing they do, then they go down to the tooth. Now, this has been distorted a little bit because there are brighteners that you can get. And you do this at home and blah, 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 right? Well, that's going to make them really bright and then they're going to fall out looking really, really nice. Because that's not really the cleaning that needs to be done, is it? Okay? So there's a problem there. The bait and switch has been taken out and sold alone as a standalone product. And that's not a healthy thing. So you do need to go to the dentist, and you do need to have a teeth clean and grind it out and pull that calculus out. Because that will protect you from having a perfectly sound tooth that will fall out. Okay. And when we get the infection down in the level of the roots and into the bone, it can be a serious infection. We can get osteomyelitis of the jawbone. I mean, these can get pretty, pretty bad. Okay. And it's all avoidable by an every 6 month kind of thing when you get it straightened out. Advise people that you're selling this brightener for $29.95 that they also need to get the teeth cleaning. And that brightness is not the same as teeth cleaning. Peritonitosis. Now, I just talked about teeth falling out of people in their 40s and 50s and 60s. Peritonitosis is a problem associated with malnutrition. And the teeth are falling out now if you are 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. As soon as your permanent teeth come in, they start falling out. Now, the baby teeth, the deciduous teeth, like the leaves, deciduous tree leaves that fall off the side of it. Deciduous teeth, the big teeth, they're designed to fall off, right? But the other ones are not designed to fall off, right? So if you go to do some volunteer work, we see this in the United States, but you also see it elsewhere, and you'll see people who are maybe 8, 10, 12, certainly in their teens, and they have a significant number of teeth missing. 4, 5, 6 teeth gone. That must have been an accident or something. No, it's malnutrition that leads them to, and of course not getting good dental care as well, but the malnutrition is the underlying common problem. And it's not, in the United States, typically, it's not that they are starved to death, but rather they're eating all the wrong kinds of foods. Okay? So they're not eating enough protein, they're eating too many carbohydrates, they're eating too much candy, etc. But the imbalance of the diet. So that's the loss of tooth in someone who's a teenager. And if you do any traveling around, you do volunteer work in Appalachia and so on, it's a very common situation. The people in their 20s and 30s get the rest of the teeth taken out and they get dentures. Okay. If you're growing up in suburban America, dentures are something maybe your great grandfather had or something like that. Okay. You don't see that in your culture, but if it's in a culture that has malnourished states, that's not an unusual common situation at all. The organism that's associated with a lot of this kind of problem are actinomycetes species. Actinomycetes are a fungus-like bacteria. They're a gram-negative organism, but they are a fungus-like organism, so it has branching and very strange cellular morphology. But it's not a fungal organism. It's a bacterial organism. There is some interesting evidence to suggest, but it hasn't been nailed down completely, that the source, at least in some settings, of actinomycetes species, which are associated with periodontal disease, are household pets. So you see the little puppy licking the person's face, adding actinomycetes to them. Okay. So that's certainly a problem. Of course, if you watch the puppy and what else they lick, you may not want them to lick your face as well, but that's a secondary problem. So actinomycetes. GI tract, infections and intoxication. Some definitions first. Pure form and essential form. Pure form and essential form. So we have an infection, which is the increase in the number of organisms. The organism is growing in your body. That's an infection. By the way, disease refers to an impairment of some bodily function. And not necessarily directly related. Eventually, yes, but not immediately. So we have the organism growing and ultimately causes disease. So the infection is the organism is growing. Intoxication is when the organism is producing an exotoxin. Note the term here, exotoxin. We're not talking about the role of endotoxin here, but rather the role of exotoxin. So in this definition, exotoxin is the only one we're talking about. Pure forms are those settings in which the microorganism is either growing and causing a disease, or is producing a toxin, an exotoxin, and causing an intoxication. One or the other is a pure form. Essential form means both are present, both the growth of the organism and the presence of a toxin. As we look into the disease state more carefully, one of those two is typically a dominant feature, and the other one is a minor feature. How do we distinguish it? Well, we say, if something is essential intoxication, that means we have the growth of the organism and the production of the toxin. Essential intoxication. So we have both present, but toxin is the problem. If they're both present, but infection is the problem, it's essential infection. So pure infection, pure intoxication, essential infection, essential intoxication. Four possibilities. As soon as you see the word essential, you know that both are there, but whatever phrase follows is the dominant feature. organisms. Most of these are gram-negative, but not all. Staph aureus is gram-positive. The others are gram-negative. Salmonella species. There are over 100 different Salmonella species. We started naming them after famous salmonellologists who were studying salmonellosis, but we ran out of famous people. So then we named them after cities of the world, which keeps us okay for the next couple of centuries. Yeah. So there are many, many, many Salmonella species. If we would do the genetics on Salmonella, Escherichia coli, Shigella organisms, and Vibrio cholera, the organism that causes cholera, these are all gram-negative rods, and are probably genetically close enough to be different species of the same genus. If we actually did the genetics on them, there's not that much difference. Okay? But because we didn't have the genetic analysis available when we named them in the 1800s, they go by standalone critters. But bear in mind, they're pretty much the same thing, except they got some little nuances that are different. So, Salmonella species, 1,200. They can all cause a gastroenteritis. So if you drink the organism in or have it contaminated in a food source, then you can then overwhelm your defense system and have a GI tract problem, a gastroenteritis. A lot of bile sounds and a lot of gas being produced by the organism. Okay. So when we feed our body carbohydrates, the carbohydrates will be fermented, and as we ferment those carbohydrates, we'll produce gas. CO2 is a common one. Others are possible. Okay. Flatulence is an outgrowth of that, a lot of gas. But we have this GI tract problem. It may be associated with nausea. It may be associated with diarrhea. The typical American has such a salmonellosis about 3 times a year. Okay. You thought it was the 37th beer that you had at the picnic. That may have been part of the problem. But the feeling that you had the next day, which the French call mal général, that's what we're talking about. They just don't feel too good. I don't think I want to go and ride a roller coaster today. I just feel a little queasy in my stomach. I'm not throwing up. If I do, it's not much. I just don't feel too good. This is the GI tract gastroenteritis. Very common. Followed often by a loose stool. Not really diarrhea, but some gas and loose stool, and you went to the bathroom 3 times, 3 bowel movements this morning. Starting to feel a little bit better, but still don't feel good. It takes about 24 or 36 hours to get over that. Where do we get it? We have to do common. Well, the organism is found in the intestinal tract of animals such as chickens. And so it's found in the chickens. Occasionally it's found in the ovaries of the chickens, which is sort of an interesting way of delivery. Because it's packaged in a nice, perfectly hard shell, and then if we eat a raw egg, then you get it. Pretty slick. Inside the egg. The egg is not broken. It was contaminated before the shell was put on. And it delivers it. But typically we get it feeding chicken. And when manufacturing the process of the chicken, it's not like you go back to the backyard and you whack off the head and so on. And you go to the store and you buy it. That was a machine-delivered system. In other words, we have machines that zip open with the little saw that we cut open the organism, the chicken. First you kill it, and then you put it in the water, and you pull it. Machine removes most of the feathers and so on, and then it dips into another and mixes off. And it's all this dipping. They're under bear belts, and they dip into the water, and they come out. And then something zips them open, and then they have a machine that sucks them out like a vacuum cleaner, sucks out the intestinal tract. Things splatter all over the place. And so it's not in the meat, but the intestinal contents are splashed on the surface of the chicken. Okay. Eventually it finds its way onto a little yellow plastic thing, a little diaper, and then put it in the vacuum pack. Right? And you go to the store and you open it up. He said, well, I just got it from the store. It's got to be sterile. Oh, great. Okay. The whole surface is covered with salmonella. So now when you open up this cellophane, the inside of the cellophane's got salmonella on it. Okay. And of course, that little diaper thing there, that's got salmonella. And the little tray's got salmonella. And now you've got salmonella. Okay. And you cut a cutting board, and you've got salmonella on the cutting board. So it's all over the kitchen, salmonella. As soon as you brought that in, it opened up, it's all over the kitchen. Then you take the chicken part, you do wings or whatever, and cook it out on the grill. So you take it out on the grill on a plate, and you cook it. Now when you're cooking it, you're going to be cooking it so it's well cooked, and it's going to be cooked on the outside, and that's where most of the organism is. It's not in the meat. Right? Was it in the muscle, splashed on the surface? So by cooking it and so on, if you've got a turkey or something that you're cooking for Thanksgiving, you follow the classic directions. You take salt and you rub it inside the chicken and the turkey before you stuff it with nutrients. Right? Now, good growth in there if you're not careful, right? But by putting the salt in there through osmotic lysis, you'll kill the organisms. That's why the salt is there, not for taste. Okay. So now we have cooking, and if you're not careful, and you put that cooked meat that you took from the grill and put it onto the dirty plate that you brought it out in, guess what? You've got contaminated again. Or if you're going to have salad, you cut it on the cutting board using the same knife and the same cutting board that you don't clean up, then you've got salmonella in salad. So when you ask patients or people, you know, what did you eat? It could be many things. The chicken was served, the chicken may have been fine, but the salad had the salmonella contamination. So it's an interesting phenomenon. I was in a meeting over in Mount Pleasant, the casino, the meetings there, about 2 years ago or so. And luck had it, I had an afternoon class, and I couldn't come to the dinner, and I needed to make it to the banquet, but I made it to the meeting afterwards and so on. And the next morning, you know, two-thirds of the people were sick. They had salmonellosis. And the health department wanted to capture all the salads and all that kind of thing. But there was tribal restrictions. The state of Michigan just can't go on to tribal land and take things. So it took a while for them to get clearance and so on. I later, one of the other hats I have on part of the state association of microbiology, as president, so talking to the health department of the state, they told me that eventually all the samples they got were too old and blew in and on, but they suspected it. So basically, this gets usually in the food system, right? And we then eat the organism. Chicken is a common source, not the only place. Pet turtles are good. Amphibians will have the organism in their intestinal tract, and we keep them associated with water. You know, they swim around the turtles and stuff like that. And of course, they're into the water, and the fecal material is into the water, and the kid is playing with a turtle, and bingo, kid eats something and comes down with salmonella. Pet turtle, another source. Now, the salmonella, a little epidemiology sort of interesting, you have to be exposed to a certain concentration. And depending upon the quantity of food that you ate, whether it was an empty stomach at the time, how much of the organism you got per unit time, if it was casual exposure to peanuts, and you only had a few, and they ate a little bit more, but they didn't get a whole lot. So the number of organisms is important, because you can tolerate some, but not over a certain limit. And so the diluted amount of food that you ate, it would be the concentrated amount. So that's why some people will come down with problems and other people won't, but everybody supposedly ate the same food. You need the same amount of organisms. So we get salmonella. Salmonellosis is that general infection, salmonellosis. Well, of those people who get this 3 times a year problem, and you've had it several times, and you will get it several times a year, it's mild generalis. A small number of patients, usually patients who are immunocompromised, this could be immunocompromised because of age, again, under the age of 5, between 3 months and 5 years of age, or over the age of 65 or some arbitrary age point in the elderly population. People who are leukemia patients or cancer patients or AIDS patients and so on. Those people who are immunocompromised patients, they are at risk of getting a gram negative septicemia. Now, in that setting, when we have a gram negative organism in the bloodstream, this is still an infectious process, just as the initial process was infectious. So we can say that gastroenteritis was pure infection using their terminology. And now we still have a pure infection. We have a gram negative septicemia, however, and now we have, as part of that pure infection, we have the release of endotoxin. And now we have endotoxic shock. And so some of those patients who are exposed to contaminated food or water will come down with gram-negative septicemia, and extremes of age and other categories of risk will potentially die. But most people who die of these food poisoning problems are in this category. They went to this next stage, went to gram-negative septicemia. Now there is one organism that is associated with an essential infection, that is, there is toxin production, and that's typhoid fever. And the organism is Salmonella typhi, T-Y-P-H-I. Salmonella typhi, one organism. You can say we start out with hundreds, and then many of the hundreds can go on to the next stage depending upon host factors. Right? We have one organism, however, Salmonella typhi. This organism causes typhoid fever. There is an exotoxin. It can affect heart function in the patient and trigger fevers in the patient, but this is, and it can kill you. Typhoid fever is a potential problem. Now, we mentioned that the top five, four out of that five, are all gram-negative organisms. And as it turns out, gram-negative organisms are particularly susceptible to sunlight, that is UV light, and chlorination. So how do we prevent Salmonella and these other agents from causing widespread problems? We do so with the use of chlorinated water, sanitation systems, UV light used as part of that. So we take the water and we filter it. We do different grades of gravel and sand. We expose it to light. We have the pipes basically that run through the pipes and then chlorinate. And then we also use chlorine. So that's the good news. Sometimes we can see it sprayed in the air of some of the sanitation can be like a little fountain kind of thing. Again, getting UV light. One of the things about the sanitation system in the United States is the sanitation system in the United States is funded by tax dollars. Tax dollars by local assessment. Local assessment of year-round residents. So if we have a resort area or a place that has a number of people who come visit it, on occasion, St. Ignace with their car show or some place along the lakes or the oceans or something like that. A small resort town that has less than 10,000 people in it, but in the summertime they have 100,000 visitors, has a sanitation system designed for 10,000 people. Okay. So what happens when the sanitation system is full? Usually these resort areas are associated with water, a river, a lake, an ocean. And the sanitation system usually takes the effluent, that is what comes out, and puts it into that water source. Typically it's all chlorinated, and it's all been UV lighted and filtered and so on. However, when there's a great volume in there, it's two choices. Either it goes back where it came from, or it goes out partially treated. Typically, that's what happens. It doesn't go back where it came from, that is, it doesn't back up in your house. That's where it came from, the toilet. People get all bent out of shape when neighbor's stuff floating up into their bathroom. And so basically, then, we have the partially treated sanitation system that goes that washes out into the lake, the water, or the river. If you live in Grand Rapids, Michigan, they got their sanitation system in the 1920s, and they wanted to be really, really clean. Sanitation was a relatively new idea. It didn't begin until the 1890s. The concept didn't hit the real larger cities of the world until the turn of the century. And so 1910, 1918, that period of time, that's when we started getting sanitation in France and in Paris, not all France, just bigger cities, Berlin and so on. Baghdad, by the way, they used to have a really good one. And then so on, we have all these different kinds of sanitation systems. In the United States, we have Boston and Chicago and so on. So by the time we got to Grand Rapids, it was the 1920s and so on. And they wanted to be squeaky clean, so they decided not only that which you flushed on the toilet, but even that which came down as rainwater and went into the sewer system. Seemed like a good idea at the time. However, now, anybody that's downstream from Grand Rapids, every time it rains, all the additional rainwater, which now is covered, we have streets and we have asphalt and we have parking lots and so on, but rainwater used to go into the soil, now goes drained into the drain. Plus, we have an expanded city area where we have suburban areas that tap into the system and all that sort of stuff. So we have a lot more fluid going through that system. And when it rains, it fills up. And rather than backing up into people's houses, it goes into the river and goes down the stream. So then they announced, because it was only partially treated, these days not totally raw, but partially treated, meaning there could be still some organisms in it, they say, don't touch the water. These are the health advisory. Don't touch the water. So if your dog goes in the water, you have to clean the dog. You can't go swimming in it. You can't kayaking in it or whatever. And it takes about 3 days for it to go all the way down to the lake, where one again goes out and gets 15,000 in the lake. Remember the concentration of salmonella in particular. The concentration of these organisms is an important degree of health hazard. So when it gets diluted out, it's nothing better. Okay. But it's sort of an oddity because we tend to think that was really crude stuff and we don't do that anymore. No, we still do that. In fact, it's even worse than that. Remember I said that most of the sanitation was a turn of the century? Well, if you think about it, when a city grows, we simply add on. The city center, the core, has got the same stuff. If you go into Boston and San Francisco or Chicago, the inner city areas have pipes that are 100 years old. Pipes don't last 100 years. They leak. So it's leaking all over the system. It's like a big sieve. To replace that is a major infrastructural change. Billions and billions of dollars. Okay. New York City started something about 20 years ago, and they estimated it was going to cost about $3 billion by boroughs in New York City. They've spent over $25 billion, and they've only gotten a little bit done. So this is a very expensive thing. If you imagine that city in the cross-section, it's just not like that sewer pipe there. There could be subways there. There could be electrical lines. There could be telephone lines. There could be gas lines. It's a crossword. It's all kinds of things crossing in different directions. So as you dig down and try to get that, because that was really early, so that it's really a major, major deal. Everything has to be disconnected and reconnected in that. A lot of work. And the longer we go before we do it, the more problems we'll have. Typically, the way we do things is we wait until we have infections. So that means we're going to wait until we start getting typhoid fever again as a common problem. Now, we still get typhoid fever in Michigan, but it's unexplainable. It's usually a camp, a religious camp, church camp, or maybe Boy Scout or Girl Scout camp, in which we have a outhouse. And they move the outhouse around every once in a while. And when they move it, sometimes they move it where also near the well, that people are drinking the water that's not fully filtered, and therefore they're getting it. So it's usually the close proximity of their source of water and their sanitation system. Got to keep them apart, simple community health thing, but they don't, and when they don't, they'll have salmonella. So where did that salmonella organism come from? It came from one of us. In other words, if you were ever exposed to the salmonella organism, a small number of populations of people will retain the organism for a long, long time. So they won't get ill, and if they have a strong immune system, maybe they won't even get into the bloodstream, and maybe they won't even get to the stage of getting typhoid fever. But they have the organism that has that possibility. A small number of the population has the ability to have the organism grow in their gallbladder, of all places. Now, how would the organism select one person in which they're going to grow in their gallbladder? How does that come about? How does that come about? you already didn't know that John Brown is going to be our carrier for typhoid fever. How did that come about? How was it selected? How was John Brown selected? Not a clue. It's bad luck. It's bad luck. But it had to do with... What's that?
The organism died
in for him. The organism died in for him. It's an entity with a thinking mind and evil intent. Or could it be receptors like matching?
Yes.
Okay. So common pili, the surface of the organism, matches the gallbladder of a small number of population, and they are our carrier. And they, every time they eat something with lots of fat in it, and the gallbladder is triggered into action, it squeezes out organisms by the millions per milliliter, and that goes into the sanitation system. But because we use fluorination and so on, we're getting rid of that organism. So the carrier has the disease, has the organism, doesn't know they have the organism because they had the disease and no longer having the symptoms, but they have the organism. So the carrier is always in the population. Anytime we have a disruption of chlorination of water, we have the potential of typhoid fever. Okay. Or any of these other agents we're talking about, particularly now the typhoid fever. The World Health Organization recognizes this, and every time there's a break in the sanitation system someplace, an earthquake, flood, tornadoes, wars, immediately we try to get tankers of water there and give the people the milk jugs to get water. We know that we don't. We have about 10 days. Within 10 days, somebody in that population is going to contaminate the drinking water for everybody else. And within 10 days, there will be an epidemic of typhoid fever. And within that epidemic, there will be many people that die, particularly the children between the ages of 3 months and 5 years of age and the older population. So we can save thousands of lives by just getting into clean drinking water. We can't find that one person. You might be that one person. I might be that one person. Okay. So we don't know who that carrier is, but they are in the population. And it's not something that we see only in South America. It happens here. Okay. We are not special human genes, human beings with special genes, and we don't have these problems. No, we have sanitation, except when it doesn't work. So anytime there's a break in the sanitation, we need to have good clean drinking water. Well, we've got 10 days before we have an outbreak of typhoid fever. So that's why you'll see the World Health Organization vigorously get into the areas when we had problems in Sarajevo and so on, in the Yugoslavia area. Now people were getting shot at waiting in line with the drinking water. Snipers and all that kind of stuff. Because the sanitation was gone. Earlier I mentioned Baghdad, not by accident. Baghdad used to have a very, very good sanitation system. And there was very few of these diarrheal diseases that we're just talking about now and continue to talk about, the GI tract problem, in the city of Baghdad. But after Desert Storm 1, the number of cases shot way high. And the people that were dying were the children between 3 months and 5 years of age, and the elderly. We were using what we call smart bomb technology. Bombs that had lasers and targets that could find a person, go in a building, the window of a building, that kind of stuff. Okay? So we were using smart. So there used to be 8 sanitation centers in the city of Baghdad, and I think we destroyed 5 of them. By accident, 5 of them? Interesting. Did they actually destroy 5 of them by accident with a smart bomb? And we were concerned that the other side in this coalition war, the other side was going to use germ warfare on our troops on this side. That never turned out. Saddam supposedly had it, but didn't use it, or whatever the story was. It never happened. There was a concern. But the practical matter was, who used germ warfare? Just a thought. Who destroyed the sanitation system? Oh, okay. Escherichia coli. E. coli. Normal flora in your intestinal tract. And while it's in your intestinal tract, it is not a bad thing. Okay. out of the intestinal tract, it can cause urinary tract infections. It's got common colitis, which don't. Can cause gram-negative septicemia if it gets in the bloodstream. Can cause pneumonia meningitis because it has a capsule if it gets out. But the normal fluoride, it's not going to cause a problem. The normal fluoride E. coli generally does not cause a problem inside the gut. We do use the presence of E. coli and similar normal flora organisms to test water. We do water supply tests and we find out that you cannot swim, stay out of the Boardman River up in Traverse City, or how do we know the water was really contaminated downstream from Grand Rapids and all that sort of stuff? Or you're going to put a well in, you want to know it's contaminated or whatever. We water test. And we don't look for all the possible pathogens, there's many of them. We just look for human fecal contamination. And an indicator organism is E. coli, among a few others. So we use it as an indicator of fecal contamination from a human source. And that indicator is sufficient to then say that the water is contaminated, even though we did not necessarily look for or find a specific human pathogen. The normal flora organism does have some use because of that kind of epidemiological analysis. However, this nice guy can be invaded by viruses and can pick up exotoxins. And so we have two varieties of E. coli. ETEC and EHEC. These are the nasty guys. The first one, enteropathic, meaning it's causing a problem in the gut, so it's not the normal guy. Enteropathic, toxigenic E. coli. The EC at the end of it, E. coli, okay. So enteropathic, meaning it causes a problem in the gut. That's not the normal guy, so it's the enteropathic strain. Enteropathic, toxigenic E. coli. ETEC. ETEC. This goes by a variety of other names. It goes by the summertime diarrhea, infantile diarrhea, and when we put these together, we get swimming pool diarrhea. Your old takes a dump in the pool. How many people have been lifeguards? Lifeguards yet? Was that about a day and a half of chlorination after somebody does that in the pool?
24 hours.
Okay, there you go. Right. So they close the pool down and have to chlorinate the pool. So it's swimming pool diarrhea. You may know it more commonly as Tijuana, two-step Montezuma revenge, or more broadly speaking, traveler's diarrhea. All of these then are related to this particular variety, ETEC, that's enteropathic toxogenic E. coli. So think of it as toxogenic E. coli and traveler's diarrhea. See how the T's line up there? This organism produces a couple of exotoxins. One is got the pure protein, the other protein and carbohydrates. The carbohydrate seems to protect it against boiling a little bit. And so it's got some protection against boiling. The others can get you more easily. The boiling water, you have to boil it a little longer than normal, more than the 10 minutes typically, to destroy the toxin, not the organism, no, just the toxin. You may have a chance to travel someplace, and when people travel, classically to Mexico, it would be easier. When American travels to Mexico, they don't drink water. However, within minutes of getting there, they have a drink that has little plastic treatments in it, little people floating in it, and all kinds of slices of fruit they've never seen before, and some ice cream floating around in it. Freezing does not kill the organism. So within minutes, as that ice cube melts, they are sucking down the E. coli. Then they go to the room, and see that there's a bottle of water that says portable water, that is drinking water. But they don't drink the water. So they just leave that aside. They don't drink that. However, in the morning, they take a shower, or whenever they take a shower, and they're in there drinking the water. As it comes out of the shower, it's spitting it out, and that's going to happen in the shower. And when they brush their teeth, this very fancy-looking, gold-plated, very nice, luxury hotel, and they turn on the water, and out comes E. coli, and they're brushing their teeth with E. coli. You never drink the water. You never drink the water. They're just brushing your teeth with E. coli. That portable water is for you to brush your teeth with. Well, it's just fancy, it must be good. It's a nice fancy hotel. Golden fixtures and everything. They're walking around the streets and they don't drink the water, but they have a salad in the restaurant that is rinsed with the water. Okay. And so on and so on. You can see what happens. It takes about 3 days and they start having a rumbling in their gut. Okay. They'll have a moderate abdominal distension and some pain. Gas is forming there, and then they'll have some loose stools, some diarrhea. And that will last probably 4 days or so. Okay. So you've been exposed to the organism for 2 or 3 days, 4 days of illness, so now we're about day 6 or 7 or thereabouts. And about this point in time, we begin to see the effect of that secretory antibody. It really gets a good level of production around day 10. A secretory antibody, the one that didn't have any memory to it, is now kicking in. So they're getting over it. Now what about the people they met there? Juan and Juanita and Francisco and Isabella and all those people. They were doing all this stuff, eating all that stuff. They didn't get sick. How is that possible? Well, because the week before, when you were drinking boiled rapid water, they were drinking contaminated water. And so that last week's exposure gives them protection this week, and so it goes week after week. Low-level exposure results in low-level protection. There's no memory, but a constant exposure gives us constant protection. So if you want to get even with them, you bring them back to boiled rapids for about 10 days or so, then you can drink good chlorinated water, and then send them home to get diarrhea. Okay. So that's why they don't get it. So if you live down there, you don't have a problem, but if you're a traveler, then you have the problem. Okay. So the age range of this is going to be maybe children between the ages of 3 months and 5 years of age, because their immune system is not yet developed. The last antibody to come online about age 4 to 5 is the secretory antibody, so they are at risk of diarrheal diseases up to age about 5. The elderly population, immunocompromised people in general, and of course, travelers, hence the term traveler's diarrhea. So we have an age range, we have a little different kind of disease process. So this is an essential intoxication. The organism is growing and producing the toxin, but the problem is basically the toxin. Now, if you want, you could take something like Pepto-Bismol. Bismol-containing compounds will provide a physical block. They will cover the receptor sites to prevent this new E. coli getting in there. Okay? When you take that, you need to take it for about, oh, I don't know, probably 10 days, we'll check the physicians, but take it before you leave. And it's probably best to take the tablets, unless you want to easily identify your light that comes off the plane if the one is leaking all this pink blue. So you take the tablets, and you take them several times a day before you go. You'll know when you've titrated the business because your tongue will turn black. In fact, your entire GI tract is now black. Business is not pink. It's black. Okay. But who would want to drink black liquid to make it pink looking so it looks nice? So it's black, and your tongue is black, your saliva in the morning, you brush your teeth, it's all black. Looks like you're a pinky dog and you're a black one. Your fecal material, you'll have a moderately solid kind of thing. It's not going to be loose still, but it's going to come out like a lump of coal in color. It's just black. Okay? And it will take you probably 3 months after you stop taking it before things turn back completely to normal. Okay? But you'll decrease the likelihood of actually getting the illness. Notice this is prophylactic. This is the most effective use of this thing. Now you could take try methadone and sulfa drugs, which will kill the organism when you got it. The side effect of that is it kills all the gut organisms and causes diarrhea. So let's see, if you have diarrhea, we take a drug and give them diarrhea. This is not necessarily all that great. Now, if the person was an immunocompromised person and they're concerned about spreading the treatment, for the average person, treatment with antibiotics is not appropriate. Okay. See you next time.